Questions for you, and I can barely see you because of the spotlights, but I can. How many of you guys work on teams that today you would classify yourselves as agile? These hands? I've been asking this question at TechEds for 5 or 6 years, and it was not that many years ago that you'd get the three guys over there and one over here, and now you look and most of the room's hand goes up. So it's really encouraging to see this happening, this change happening in the industry. How many of you guys would say that you are either on a team or have been on a team that does TDD, test-driven development? See, that's kind of what Agile used to look like. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, but I want to be crystal clear, we're not going to focus entirely on Agilista TDD kinds of things. Am I really loud to you, or is it just me? They say I'm loud. Are we okay, boss? All right. Okay. If everybody can hear, they're happy. So just a quick statement to kind of get us going. So the Visual Studio 11 unit testing experience is about developers. It's not about testers. It's not about managers. It's about developers. It's about people who write code every day. And we streamlined and organized a lot of things, and we enabled a lot of features that we've been hearing about for years. And it's also about unit tests. And I'll go ahead and include integration tests in that, but I'm not talking about big end-user automated magic UI-driving tests. Yes, we do some of that, and some of that works in here, but that wasn't the focus. The focus was on developers, developers who write code. So we've been getting feedback on MS Test and on Visual Studio for quite a while. When we first shipped MS Test, this was ages ago, I wasn't even a Microsoft employee. I was looking through my blog recently and I found the post where I said, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. Unit testing is going to be built in. I won't have to use NUnit anymore. And then we all used it and went back to using NUnit. Because it was slow, it seemed like the features were kind of like not quite right. Like they weren't the way we were used to them. There were things there that were weird. I mean, what the heck was a deployment item all about? I mean, there's just all these strange things that we just didn't get. So we went back to NUnit. The other thing is that, of course, MS Test as a framework, as a library, it didn't really evolve very much over time. If you look at its capabilities today, it's pretty much the same as it was 6 or 7 years ago when it first shipped. Whereas the world of unit testing has actually evolved. You'd think a unit testing library doesn't need to go through a lot of evolution, but they do, and they do evolve quite a bit. Frameworks like MBUnit, which introduced the idea of data-driven row tests, where you put the attributes right in the code, NUnit and XUnit then picked that up. XUnit introduced assert.throws, which everybody then picked up. The BDD world has been happening. The fluency, right? Where you start to say these long sentences of variable should be this, so that, these big long verbs. There's a lot of evolution constantly happening as people explore what it is they want to express with their unit tests, because the unit tests are really about a conversation a developer has with their code. And MS Test struggled with that. The other problem was the experience, the actual IDE experience. The stuff in the IDE felt like it was designed for testers. Didn't feel like it was designed for devs. I mean, until Visual Studio 2010, you really didn't have a good way to right-click in the editor and run a test. That experience was clearly not focused at us. And if you were doing TDD all the time, it also really felt bad. The slow got in your way, the framework things got in your way, the not being able to run from the editor, all these things got in your way. Now, a lot of these complaints, the speed one, the running from the editor, simple things like that, those actually got addressed in Visual Studio 2010. But we clearly had more to do. So I'm just going to go right into the bits, and we'll come back to slides in a minute. What you're seeing here is a Visual Studio 2012 release candidate build, exactly the same one you can get. I'm using the Ultimate Edition. And I want to point out a few bits of the product here. So in the middle of the screen, I have some code. We'll come back to that in just a second. Over here on the left-hand side, we have the new Test Explorer window. Now, this is meant to be less data than the old test window. Okay? It's meant to be light and out of the way. It's meant not to take over half of your screen. We're trying to reduce the number of tool windows that you have to open in Visual Studio at any one time, just like You may have noticed we reduced the number of toolbars and a lot of other things. Let you focus on the code and stop focusing on other things. Now, in this build, I want to point out a few things. I'm going to go ahead and run the tests that I have in this solution. And we'll point out a couple things while it's running here. If we zoom in here. Oh, there we go. It was too fast. First of all, you'll notice there's this green bar at the top. And because I did the zoom-in game, I apologize. That bar is your status of your test run, right? So it runs across. And it's the silliest feature ever, but we've been given grief for 8 years for not having a red-green bar. This is a subtle thing, but it's one of those things that a unit testing developer really comes to depend on. You get into the habit of testing and coding and testing and coding, and just the little bar is all you really need to see. We also have search, right? So I can go here and say CTOR and filter it down to just those tests. And now if I say run, it'll only run those tests. In the search box, we have some filters. So we can filter by maybe all the failed tests, in which case there will be none. And we're adding more filters and things like that to this going forward. Go ahead and clear this out. So you can see it only ran those four tests. And so the results from the rest of them are a little bit grayed out. Again, trying to use a different user interface metaphor than having you have to deal with going back through history and multiple test runs, right? Those were not run the last time, but the last time they were run, they passed information like that. Now, the other thing we have, let me go ahead and make one of these tests fail real quick, just so we can see something here real quick. I'm just going to do a false true here. I'm going to go ahead and run them all again. I want to show you a couple of things. So a couple of things, like we make a very intentional effort to try to float the most important information you could possibly want up to the top. And if you're writing unit tests, what's the most important thing? That it failed. So we've got the failing tests at the top. The pass test group collapsed, because to be completely honest, most of the time we really don't care about those. We care about this failing one. And we can go and take a look at all of his information. Now, I just put a very short fail right there, which only caused a single line stack trace. But the stack trace is here, the stack trace is clickable, it takes me straight to the code. The source is here, it takes me straight to the code. All the things you would expect are here. We've got the message, we've got all that stuff that you need. If the test produced output and trace and debugs and all those other things, all that information is available to you. Now, of course, I just mentioned, you know, console write line and debug out and things like that. That's going to seriously overflow this tiny little space down here. So we don't put it there. What we do is we put it in a document window, and you can click to get to it. Because you don't need it all the time. What you really need is, did it fail? You click on it, you go and you fix it. So that test failed. I'll come back in here and fix it. And we'll run it again. Now, I want to point out a couple of things here. Has anybody maybe noticed this? You ever seen this fact attribute before? You have if you've used xunit.net. XUnit.net is a third-party testing framework created by Jim Newkirk and Brad Wilson. And I'm using it here intentionally to show you that we can support third-party testing frameworks. And that was one of the driving forces for us in this release, was to try to separate the experience of unit testing and the developer unit testing from the test framework itself. Give the choice back to you to use whatever test framework you want. That actually has a couple of nice little advantages. Because if we go and take a look in here, we'll go there from the code. So I have this this web API app over here. But of course, the web API app is really an MVC app, which means it has the opportunity for me to write JavaScript. And I don't know if you've ever seen one before, but that is a QUnit test. QUnit is a JavaScript unit testing framework that is created and used by the team who makes jQuery. And it's a popular framework for people who want to do unit testing in JavaScript. And I'm going to uncomment this test here because this one is going to fail. And I'll show you that in the same experience, same thing going on here in Visual Studio, I hit run, and my JavaScript tests are running as well. There it is. I'm getting the same message result information. I'm getting all of the stuff is the same. And that is a plugin provided by a third party that integrates the QUnit testing framework into Visual Studio. So there's two third-party frameworks right there. All right, let's jump back over to slides real quick, and we'll come back. Okay, so let's look at what we saw there, just to make sure, because I was zooming around and moving things. All right, so we've got the red-green bar, silly but important. Search, float the important information to the top. You may not notice the test timings. Those are actually really useful. When I am all in an entirely passing state, one of the things I like to do is I like to go find the tests that are slow. Slow test typically it means to me a test that is actually being an integration test, or is testing too much, or the underlying platform that it's using has got too much stuff going on in it, and I want to start thinking about doing some design refactoring and some decoupling. Slow tests are a really good indicator of a place you should go and take a look, as is code coverage, which we'll come to in a minute. Of course, I'm showing all of these tests from different frameworks mixed together, and we've got the same detail information, regardless of test framework, in the same place in the UI. All right. So how do we put this together? We had to make some changes to how Visual Studio's MS Test and Test Runner experience worked. We had to get down in the guts and rip it out, to be completely honest. And so we created a new thing that we call the Visual Studio Unit Test Platform. And this is basically a runner, okay? It's a test runner. It interacts between the user sitting at the top and these plugins at the bottom, and that plugin then adapts between our interface and what the test framework requires. And it turns out creating these plugins is surprisingly easy. If you want to see a few of them, the XUnit one and the one that I showed you for JavaScript are both available up on Codeplex, and you can see the code for them. The XUnit one is basically a single file with a little bit of other cruft because it has to be a V6 plugin, right? So it's got a special project type and a V6 manifest, but the code for it is one file implementing two interfaces. And we intentionally made it that light so that these would be easy to make, and so they would also be easy to deploy and use in other places, like in your Team Foundation build environment, which I list up there at the top. So that means these third-party test frameworks that I'm showing you not only are going to give you that same experience in Visual Studio, you're going to be able to push them up to your team build and get the same experience there. And you can run them from the command line and get the same experience there. So these plugins plug in from the bottom into the platform, which then flows up and the UI sits on top of the whole thing. You know, we wish we'd done this years ago, but at the time we didn't think of it. You may also be noticing there's a new green box here. Do any of you guys code professionally in C or C++ all day? There's like four over here and one or two over there. So if you guys have tried to do unit testing in Visual Studio before, you've noted that we didn't really have a very good story there. We're now shipping a native C++ unit testing experience. Doesn't require you to do any /CLR or write your unit tests in managed code. You write them in C++, you compile them, and they glue together. And that experience also plugs into us through the same interfacing structure. I'm still eager to see if anybody wants to grab something like Google Test or the Boost Unit Test Runner and see if they want to integrate that with us, but I'm hoping somebody will. So you can use any of these frameworks. And so already shipping, we have found out there in the wild, actually coordinated with a lot of these teams. We've got NUnit, XUnit, I've already mentioned those. MBUnit, which was originally created by Pelle Dehalia from Microsoft Research before he came to Microsoft, and it was the framework that first introduced this idea of a row test. The QUnit and Jasmine. Jasmine is a BDD framework for JavaScript. QUnit and Jasmine are both provided by the same runner, and that runner is called Chutzpah. It is. And you have to go up to Codeplex and find it. Or you can pick it up off the Visual Studio gallery. All of these are as easy to install as going to the gallery. So let me give you a show of that real quick. I will do that as I'm doing the next demo. And SQL Server unit testing, we've been working hard with those guys to make sure that their integration comes in through this same experience. Historically, what SQL Server unit testing was a translation into MS Test. So then it wrote that special, it coming in through the MS Test door. But we're talking to them about how interesting it would be to actually write your unit tests in SQL, save them in the database, and the runner runs them from the database. Seems like the right place to put a database unit test. So you've also probably noticed, if you've been looking at the new APIs in .NET 4.5 and the Windows Metro APIs, that there is a lot of this async stuff. And this isn't the async that we learned in .NET ages ago. This is the new async. Right, so we used to have the event async program or pattern, EAP, where you had the events firing back at you. We also had one called, I think, APM, and that was the begin-end mechanisms. And now we have the TAP, task asynchronous programming model. And I will tell you, I like this one a lot better. It just makes more sense. It makes everything feel like a function call. And you have much more control and fine-grained control over them without having to spend your time worrying about the state machine that makes async code not barf and deadlock on you. But when you're dealing with async, you suddenly have to think about how that works in your unit test code. Because consider this some long-running operation. So I might assert something on it. Suppose it's an operation that causes a side effect, right? So it returns void, it goes off async for a long period of time, and then updates a property in the view model. And in my test, I call it and check the property. And the test fails every single time, because that background thread has had no opportunity to process, to do its work. So you actually do have to build in support for this into the test frameworks, and so we built this into MS Test. You simply put the async keyword on the test, and you do have to return task. Now understand that when you say task, you actually return void. It's kind of weird, but it is what it is. The compiler builds that for you. And by doing that, we're now allowed to use the await keyword. And the await keyword lets us do intentional and conscious blocking on that task that returns from some long-running operation. And this was a really important thing as we were starting to do unit testing around our Metro app development. Because otherwise, we were going to get into a situation where you had to start managing that state machine yourself and taking that task and figuring out how to block on it and the right way to block on it and all that other mess. Now you just write the code the way you think you should. You also may have noticed that the MS Test framework in previous releases really didn't do 64-bit very well, or multi-targeting. And we've fixed that now. MS Test is now very friendly to 64 and multi-targeting. And there's really not much more to say than that. If you've run into it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, you've probably been lucky in using any CPU, which is kind of where the sweet spot was for MS Test. And the final thing about this unit testing experience that I want to call out is that this is now in all of our SKUs. Every SKU of Visual Studio 2012 has unit testing built right in. Now, there is a little bit of a distinction between what you can do at different SKUs, mostly because the Express SKU doesn't let you do plugins. And it's not really that we don't, it's that the Express SKU doesn't. So let me show you some interesting async code, because this is one of those things that can be fun to play with. Okay. Just for fun, I'm going to make us up a new project. All right. And if you guys haven't seen this before, it's kind of fun. It is the NuGet Package Manager console. And it lets you grab packages like NUnit and XUnit and all kinds of other wonderful things from this magical place in the cloud. And it downloads them and puts them in your project and creates all the references for you. So now when I want to get XUnit or NUnit, I just do this. Install package XUnit. Done. OK. So that means now I can write XUnit tests, which are facts. We can talk to Jim Newkirk and Brad Wilson about why they chose that word, but they did. And we'll just quickly write a little test that demonstrates the problem I mentioned a minute ago. So we're going to new up a class. Okay, and we'll come back to what that guy is here in just a second. So we'll make this async class here. And I want to call a long-running operation on him. So we'll just say sut.long running, two n's. Okay. Now remember, the situation that is particularly painful for us here is when this thing causes side effects. So I'll just demonstrate that one real quick. We're going to put a property on this class, because you can simulate this. The idea here, right, we're doing a model view view model in our Metro app or in our WPF application. It doesn't really matter. We've got a property that is going to be a string, and we have our long-running operation. Okay, and Just to prove that there really is some long-running stuff going on here, I'm going to bring in the thread.sleep call, and we're going to have him sleep for 2 seconds. Then he's going to update the string. Okay. So now what we want to be able to do, clearly, is we want to be able to assert on that. All right. Now this test, despite the sleep 2000, I've got to make it do this. Here we go. Remember, I said this is an async operation, so I'm using the task async library, so it needs to return a task. Okay. Ah, yes. Sorry for the lambdas. If you're not familiar with lambdas, you're probably going to have to become familiar with them here pretty soon. All right, so what does this do? We create a task, a plain task. This has task with no payload. And we say run. And we provide it a lambda. Visual Studio's compiler will create the necessary state machine and magic goo so that a background thread gets spun off and scheduled, and then the code inside of that lambda will run. Okay? Down here, we're going to check that property. So this test is going to run and return instantly. And it's going to fail because we got back null. We didn't wait long enough. Now, in the olden days of async testing, what we might have wanted to do is we might have wanted to, you know, play the same kind of a game. All right, well, if I sleep for 2100 seconds, I'm probably cool. And that might work, but it certainly isn't going to be dependable. This is going to lead you to those kinds of situations where you have the so-called flaky tests. Right, the tests that pass on my machine and fail on his machine and sometimes fail on the build server. This is not a happy place for you to be in. So instead, let's take advantage of task async. And what we're going to do is we're going to tell the test runner that our test needs to be thought of in an async manner. And then we're going to use this await keyword, which allows us to block on that operation. We can get rid of that thread sleep. And now our test runs just fine. Excellent. A green test. Green light, go, write more code. Okay? So this is now natively supported in MS Test. However, you noticed I was showing it to you in XUnit. XUnit also supports it. We should expect to see more and more of the test frameworks providing this support, since this async pattern is becoming very, very strong in both the .NET APIs and in the Windows APIs. We're seeing it everywhere. Because as we're building apps that are always connected, connecting to social services, doing all this stuff, we want the UIs always to remain responsive. And the way to do that is with this kind of a programming model. Okay. All right, we continue on here. So, one of the questions that comes up a lot for us is, okay, so you completely gutted and replaced the Visual Studio unit testing experience. What's going to happen to my old stuff? We have worked very, very hard to maintain strong, strong compatibility with Visual Studio 2010 projects. They should just work. Now, sometimes the test runner, internal to itself and without you even having to worry about it, will actually switch some of its internal behaviors in order to kind of run in 2010 mode. And the reason that happens is, remember back at the beginning when I said our focus here was about developers. Developers writing unit and integration tests while they write their code. One of the most important things to you when you're in that mode, when you're doing code a little, test a little, code a little, test a little, is that everything runs as fast as you possibly can. You don't want to wait, ever. And so what we did is we created a very stripped-down version of the MS Test test runner that's only really capable of doing unit and integration tests. It doesn't know how to do all the other things that MS Test knew how to do in 2010. And so when we can use that runner, we do. And so that way, if you are just doing unit testing, if you're doing TDD, if you're doing integration tests, tests that test code, it screams fast, okay? Now, it will sometimes drop back to that old mode if it has to, if it finds certain kinds of artifacts in your code that demonstrate that this came from a 2010 world, or if you start introducing some of those things into your 2012 project. And in Team Foundation Build for 2012, when you set up your test runs, one of the things you can do is you can actually tell it, no, I want you to always use the old runner. You might have a reason that you need it to always use the old runner. And so you can configure it there as well. And of course, hopefully you guys have been seeing that, you know, the round tripping back and forth between 2012 and 2010 is pretty good. So you can actually live on a team with other people who are using MS Test in their 2010 Visual Studio, and the two of you can coexist just fine. So when you're writing unit tests and even integration tests, I mentioned that you want them to run fast. They should always run as fast as possible. But especially when we start to talk about unit tests, it's important to think about what a unit is. To me, a unit test is a test that tests the smallest bit of code that I can test in isolation from other bits of code. So in order to achieve that, I have to be able to isolate it. I have to be able to remove those other things from my running environment so that I can write a test that tests this method and this method only. A failure elsewhere won't cause this method to fail when I'm writing a unit test. However, when I'm writing an integration test, that's me bringing large chunks, many things together to test them when they work together. There are two different kinds of tests. They're very important, each. But when you're writing the unit tests, you need this isolation. And in 2012, you can see I still had 11 here because we hadn't announced the name when I built the slide. We've introduced this new framework called the Fakes framework. And Fakes provides two different kinds of avenues for you to achieve this isolation. One is stubs. And if you're familiar with things like MOQ and NMOC and other things, it's a very similar concept. Basically, it's a concrete class that implements an interface or derives from your class and provides the ability for you to override virtual methods. They're very lightweight. They run extremely fast. And they're easy to use. The other one that we introduced is one called shims. And this is derived from the Microsoft Research Moles project. Anybody use Moles? Okay. I say derived from because I want to be crystal clear. It is not Moles. Okay. The profiler engine is completely different. A lot of the code generation is different. We did a lot of work here. But basically what shims does is shims uses runtime interception. It lets you get in the way of almost anything in .NET and swap it out, replace it with something new. This is pretty cool. This is pretty powerful. In fact, I have a whole talk on this later on in the week where we're going to go really deep with shims and block out some things that you might be very surprised I can block out or that I might need to block out. And so if you're interested in getting in much deeper into the Fakes product, we should talk about that there. But I will give you a very quick demonstration of what we can do with it here. So I'm going to go back over to that project I had just a minute ago. And I'm not in JavaScript. And so if we take a look at this class that we're testing, this ViewModel class, you can see right here, this class takes an interface on its constructor. This is a typical dependency injection pattern. We have a class that depends on something else. We express that via an interface on the constructor. This is a good practice. Now, when I want to test this class, I clearly have to resolve that interface. I have to provide one. And I don't want to provide a real one. I want to provide one that my test controls. This gets back to that idea of being a unit test and not an integration test. Now, again, I am going to have integration tests that test this with the one from the system, but they're different. And trust me, the actual implementation of this class reaches out to the U.S. Geological Survey and queries a JSON call to get a whole bunch of records back about earthquake data. You don't want that in your test runs every single time you run your tests. It's going to take too long. You want it to be faster than that. So you put in a replacement. This is where the stubs come into being. To create the stubs and the fakes in general, I basically go to the test project, and I find the reference. Wrong project? Nope, right project. There we go. I right-click on it, and I say, add fakes assembly. So we do this at compile time. We're going to process that assembly. We're going to run a bunch of reflective analysis over it. We're going to pop out all the types that we feel like processing. And then we're going to generate up a new assembly and add a reference to it in your test project. This is one of the reasons things run as fast as they do for us. So after having done that, I will get this new reference, which is the same as my original one, .fakes. And now these types are available to me. I get full IntelliSense on them and everything. They're all just right here. So since I'm going to be testing this view model, I know that I have to be able to new one up, like I have right here. And I need to be able to pass in one of these service proxies. So the line above is newing one up. This is the stub. It has a method on it called getDataAsync. There it is. And I assign it to a Lambda expression. Well, honestly, to any delegate. I could use a delegate of a function inside of this class as well. I find the Lambda expressions are very convenient. So this is a very simple way now for me to create an iEarthquake service proxy, provide it to the system I'm testing, and get to work. And the one I'm doing here, this task.from result, is because the method that I'm testing is async. And so I have to figure out how to take my sample data and wrap it up into an async IEnumerable task thing. And that's just a shortcut way of doing that. If you want more on that, actually, I wrote a blog post on it. You can go read about that. So that's it. That's stubs, very easy, very lightweight, extremely fast running. Now, the other thing that happens sometimes is you need to get in the way. You need to block something out. Let me show you some system code that is going to make my point. If we take a look at this start timer method right here, you see anything interesting about it that's going to make it hard to unit test? The dispatch timer, right? The dispatch timer is going to be very problematic for me when I do unit testing. Because there are a number of things I want to test about this method. I want to test that every second it updates the message, that after 30 seconds it calls refresh data, that it calls refresh data before ever updating the message in the first place, that it remembers even to call start on the dispatch timer. Admittedly, those tests will be tightly coupled to the implementation, but I don't really have a choice in this case, because I'm not injecting a timer provider or something like that, which would be, you know, the object-oriented purist way of doing it. But we all write code like this all the time. And you still want to be able to test it. So when I need to test this, I'm going to use shims now. And shims are going to let me carve that dispatch timer out and provide my own implementation of it without having to change the code. Let me show you what that looks like. All right. It's a bit of a longish test, so you have to forgive me that. So this bit of code that starts here with shim dispatch timer got all instances right here. What does all instances mean? Well, remember, inside of that function we were looking at, it newed up a dispatch timer. So in order for me to get in the way of that, I actually have to say, I want to get all of them everywhere. And that's what this all instances does. So this is the shim of the dispatch timer class from system. I'm going to say every single one of those that you find anywhere in the world in this app domain. Remember, there was a tick event, right? And the tick event, when you look at an event in .NET, is kind of like a property, except that instead of having get and set, it has add and remove. Well, this is the add one. And it's the add one that takes an event handler. So I'm just going to replace that, and I'm going to replace that with this Lambda expression over here that is just a simple delegate. It takes the instance pointer, which I call at this as a shortcut just to remind me, but you know, that is the this pointer when you're inside the Lambda. You don't have to name it this, by the way. You can call it whatever you want. I just do this to remind me what it is. And I'm going to take the handler that I'm given, and I'm going to save it into a local variable here. And I'm taking advantage of closures in C# to grab that variable back out here where I can use it. Okay. And then I'm going to take over a couple of his other methods and just replace them with no ops. Right? So this is me now saying, don't do anything when he does that, and don't actually start the timer, please. Now, at this point, this test, the dispatch timer that system is going to use has been cut away. Its implementation will not run. And I said that these replacements occur everywhere in the app domain. So, you know, there's a possibility maybe that the test framework might use dispatch timer, or I might swap out datetime.now, or I might swap out something else, and we have a problem if that's taking over in the entire app domain. So in order to address that, we make you provide a scoping region, and that's what this line right here does. If you try to use shims without having provided the scoping region, we will throw. And we will basically, in the message that you'll get in the test window, it'll tell you exactly what code you need to put in your test. And that way you can know and have fine-grained control over where your tests are or where the substitutions occur. So having done that, the rest of this is about setting up the rest of the things in the view model. And then I can call the start timer, and I can check various results on it that come back out. And it just works. But I'm going to show you, just to really prove the point one slightly different way, I'll create another project for us. Now, this is going to be a simple class with a static method on it that's going to return a string. And it's going to be a formatted now method. And all it's going to do is call datetime.now.toShortDateString. It's going to return that. Now, we can imagine that in a real product, a bunch of other things happen here. But if we wanted to test the thing that consumed this method, we need to make that date time now go away. So let's fix that. I'm going to go ahead and use MS test this time. So I'll say new project, test, unit test, go. Okay. Now, again, I have to add a reference, just like we've always had to do. I'll add a reference from here up to the class library. All right. And we should now be able to call class 1. Oh, he wants me to bring in a namespace. Formatted now. OK. So I'm going to write a test for that, and I'm going to hope to get it right. So we're going to do assert.r equals, and let's see, looking down here at my clock, 6/11/2012. And if I'm lucky, that test will pass. Good. But of course, it won't pass tomorrow. And if I had gone ahead and expanded it out to include milliseconds, it wouldn't have even passed now. Now, the datetime.now one perhaps isn't quite as interesting as maybe where you have something that puts a timestamp on something, right? So the test knows that when you ask the controller to create the record, it's going to timestamp it. And so in your test, what do you do? Well, this is what it was used to do. You'd create a window. You know, as long as it's sometime within the last 3 or 4 seconds, we're going to assume he timestamped it correctly. And then you have to hope that your test run doesn't violate the window. But that's clearly not a very good way to do it. So instead, let's make datetime go away. Now, datetime lives in the system reference, so I'm going to right-click on that and say add fakes assembly. You see, he added 2 files to my project, one for MS Core Lib and one for system. And that's because in .NET, the system reference is actually 2 different things. MS Core Lib is kind of the native part of it, and system is kind of the managed part of it. So we end up building 2 completely different fakes assemblies that we take a reference on. And here they are, MS Core Lib and system. And now that we have those, we can take over date time. So we're going to say shim date time. And you can see the namespace for this is always dot fakes of the namespace that the type came from. So since date time is in system, it's going to be system.fakes. So we'll go ahead and let Visual Studio bring that namespace in for me. Now, is a static property that's read-only, so it only has a getter. So the thing we're looking for is called now-get. And we'll just force a particular time in. All right, now, this test is going to fail ugly. And it's not going to fail ugly initially because of the 611, but because I did not provide that context scoping that I mentioned before. So we're going to take a look here. Through an exception. And it's basically telling a shims context must be in scope in order to register shims. Use the snippet below to fix your code. Okay. No problem here. So now our test should fail because the equals are wrong, but we expect that as well. Nope. Ah, anybody know why? I'm too late. Exactly, I was too late. I replaced it after it had been called. Gotta make sure you get that right. There we go. We'll do a little update here, and we will be good to go. Excellent. So that's fakes in a nutshell. Again, please come to my session later on in the week if you want to get into this in details. We're going to do some really ugly things with fakes. It's a lot of fun. Okay. So I do have some recommendations for you about fakes. This is the thing I often get asked for. Are these good or are they bad? Are they evil? I say yes, shims are evil, but evil things can be good. They're evil because they let you do just about anything. I mean, that's potentially scary, right? One of the things we kind of like about .NET and about structured programming and all these things is, you know, your world is kind of a little bit controlled, except now with shims, it's not. You can just go ahead and change the world a little bit. Change what date time means. Take over app domain if you wanted. You know, who knows what that's going to do to your test runner, but you could if you really wanted to. So the way I've been talking about this, and I would encourage you all to kind of take this to heart, stubs are natural. Needing to create a concrete instance of an interface or a derivative of an abstract class is a very natural way to do programming, and there's nothing weird there. Use them. It's fine. Nothing evil or wrong there. It's just about providing a local test version of the thing that you want to do. Shims are amazingly powerful, and sometimes it's the only way out of the problem you're in. It may be that it's because you have dependencies that you can't get around. It may be because you're not allowed to change that code. Maybe because you don't want to. You should want to after using the shims, as far as I'm concerned. So use the shims, get the code under test, and then the fact that you needed the shims should cause you to think a little bit about whether you need to do some redesign. We're going to talk more about that in that talk dev 411 as well. Okay. So let's keep going. We're covering kind of all of the unit testing stuff here. Of course, in the unit testing world, one of the things that we think quite a bit about is code coverage. Code coverage matters to us. We like to use it. It's a useful piece of data. I'm not a huge fan of code coverage metric requirements. Like, you can't check in unless, or things like that. But I do think it's an excellent way to continue that conversation that a developer can have with their code. Ask the question, did it cover what I thought it was going to cover? Do I need to increase my coverage here? Is this an area of risk that I'm concerned about? So we've got two different things we've added for code coverage. And first of all, we've got code coverage for our native unit tests now. I believe it's actually not working in RC, and I apologize for that, but it has been fixed since then. And also, we've got the managed one, which is going to work with the third-party unit testing frameworks, and I'll show you that right now. So if I go back over to the big project we were in just a second ago, where I had all of those tests that were written in XUnit, the easy way, have any of you used code coverage in Visual Studio 2010? Some hands? Yeah? Isn't it fun? Right? You go to your test settings file, and the thing opens up, modal dialog. And then you've got to find data and diagnostics. And then you go down here, and you check the box next to code coverage. And you click OK, and you click OK, and you run your test, and you don't get any data. And you go read some blogs, and you go and open up the thing again. And you go down to the code coverage, and you realize that there's a little thing button there that says configure. Oh. And you click that, and it shows all the projects in your system, and none of them are checked. Isn't that great? Well, I'll show you how you run code coverage in 2012. That's it. This is kind of how I always wanted it to be. Run the tests and tell me the numbers. And you can see it's telling me I have 82% code coverage, and I can dig in. And here's all my data. I can look and see that the main page view model, that class we were looking at a minute ago, is 90% covered. We can turn on the coloring, which is a very nice way to see what's going on. Although I'm not sure how, you guys can see that. Does that coloring show up for you? It's hard to tell sometimes. I actually like to change that to green. They didn't believe me. But as you can see, I got pretty good coverage in here. Surprising that it wasn't 100%. Let's look over here and figure out where it is. There we go. So I never had a test that called that one. Okay. Probably need to write one. Now, the other thing that happens, and I find this happens to me all the time, is while I'm writing a test for a piece of code, I want to know, did that test cover what I think it covered? And so that's a nice little feature we've got where I can just go and select a test or a couple of tests, whatever I want, right-click on them, and analyze just those. And it's going to do the exact same thing, one-click run, boom, I get my answer back. And now I can turn the colorings back on, and I can see that those four tests touched only the blue and not the red. A really nice way to continue that conversation with the code. And that's actually why we created it. This is created by one of the developers on our team who just found that he needed it. He was writing unit tests and he just wanted to ask the question, did that test cover what he thought it covered? And you can also use it to like you might use filtering and filter things out and find tests that are in a certain class or other things and filter them out and then run those and see if they cover what you expected them to cover. And again, I'm using XUnit and it worked. Okay. Good stuff. And that's also true on the team build as well, because when we start talking about team foundation build, we had a kind of a principle that we wanted to follow with our changes to unit testing, and it's that if it works in Visual Studio, it works in the build server. And so that means I should be able to take these third-party frameworks and push it up there. I should be able to do code coverage and push it up there. And I should continue to get that experience. Because if we don't have the build server behaving the way we expect, then we can't use it. It can't be part of that conversation. I like to have my builds turned on continuously, so every single check-in causes a build. I have also been in environments where that can't be done because the build takes too long to run. I kind of think that's a different problem, but it is what it is. And in that case, of course, you might want to say it's running continuously, where it's not every check-in, but it's every check-in since the last time we ran. But it should always be attempting to compile your code and run all of your unit tests. But it also means that in Team Foundation Build, in the cloud, we can do this. So we can take these third-party test frameworks and run them with a cloud-based build. Have any of you guys started using Team Foundation Service yet, the preview? Yeah? And you may have heard that we've got cloud-based build now. And so we can push it up there. Now, we also have test impact analysis on the build server, which is a useful thing. So we've got these third-party frameworks, the test impact analysis, and we've got cloud build. So I want to show you cloud build because this is kind of a favorite little thing of mine. The first time we turned it on, we were surprised how well it worked and how easy it was to do. So setting your system up to do a build in the cloud is really not very hard. Okay. First of all, if you have a team founder, a project on TFS Preview, then your build controller already exists. So you just go to builds. And if we look in the action, we can see I have a build controller that is my hosted build controller. Now, if I'm just going to be using MS Test, I don't have to do anything. I just configure it the way I would normally configure it, which means I'll create a workflow or a build definition. And in the build definition, it's going to take a second because it actually has to reach up to the real TFS service to pull down the process template And once it comes down here, we're going to see that the build process is configured to run any DLLs that have the word test in their name and any JavaScript files that have the word test in their name. There we go. And so we can take a look here at the automated test section. And you can see right here, I made this guy get out of our way a little bit. So run tests in sources matching test.js and star test star.dll. And this is exactly the way you do it today, except I've added the JavaScript one because I've got some JavaScript tests in this project. And once we've done that, we then have to think about how do we get those plugins. I said that in Visual Studio, the way you get a plugin is you go up to the gallery. So you use Tools Extension Manager right here. And you go online, and you type in something like NUnit. And there it is, the NUnit Test Adapter Beta 2. And you install it, and you're good to go. But how do we get that on our build server? Well, that's a little bit more complex, and it is a problem that we're working on making better than what I'm about to show you. But it's really not too bad. Basically, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that package that I got, that v6 that I got from the gallery, I'm going to unzip it, because it's just a zip file, and I'm going to check it into my source code, into my tree. So if we take a look at the source control I have for this project, we'll go over here to Source Control Explorer. What I have inside of this project is a folder called Unit Test Plugins. And all I did was unzip that JavaScript one and that XUnit one into this folder. Okay. Having done that, I have to just tell the build controller that they're there. I go back over to builds, back to the build controller. This is the part that's ugly. Forgive me, we're working on it. And then you hit properties, and then you hit this dot, 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 dot thing right here, and you go and select your folder. And what this is really doing is it's telling the Team Foundation build controller, there's more stuff here that you need. Go get it. And that'll work. Now, if you have an on-premises build controller, there's easier ways to do this, right? Because most of the time, if you have an on-premises build controller, you probably also have Visual Studio installed on the build controller. There's a lot of project types that will require you to do that. And so, provided you've done that, if you go into Visual Studio and get the plugin, that will be sufficient. But with the cloud-based one, you don't have that kind of access. So you have to check it into the code to get it there. And having done that, then it will all just work. And so we can go and take a look and see that while I was up in the speaker lounge preparing and playing around, doing check-ins and writing bad tests, I was getting builds every single time I checked in. And this was me playing around with writing failing tests and passing tests and stuff. So all of this running then on the cloud with third-party frameworks. Cool? All right. Okay. Now, I've got a couple more things that I want to cover here. And I intentionally left some time for questions. We'll see if we have it. So, my friend Chris likes to say, if you aren't running your unit tests, you're just compiling. You're not building. And Chris actually owns the Team Foundation Build stuff, so he's the one helping me try to fix that thing I just showed you. But this is an important thing because a lot of us kind of get into the habit of thinking that if my code compiles, it's probably okay. And we all know it's not. So we've added an option in Visual Studio to basically make the test run be a part of the build. It's really easy, and you may have actually noticed when I was writing code that I would occasionally kind of pause and stop because I was waiting for the tests to run for me. And that's because I always run with this thing turned on, and so I kind of forget when I'm demonstrating to you guys that I've turned it off because I wanted to save it until now. It's as easy to turn on as checking this little box right here. All I had to do. And now that I've done that, I need to force an edit or else he won't actually think anything needs to be run. So there is a failing test here. I'm going to do a build. And now that that button's turned on, he's going to run some stuff for me. Okay, now, remember I showed you some of the tests were grayed out and some of them weren't? So in order to try to streamline the process for you, because of course you don't want to wait very long, you want to get the feedback quickly, what we do is any test that did not pass the last time, we run that first. And only if those tests pass do we continue and run everybody else. We try to basically do a fail fast. And that test, that JavaScript one, continued to fail for me. So do it the old-fashioned way. Comment it out. And now you'll see that the test runner is actually going to do a run all. And there he goes, percolating his way down the list. And so now as I'm working in the code, I don't have to think about it anymore. I can just sit here and code and write new stuff and build and keep coding. You'll notice that none of this is blocking VS while I'm typing. Build again, clean up a line, build again, delete a line, build again. I just keep on going. And he's always trying to keep up with me. The idea is that this thing should always be a place where if you give it enough time to finish, granted I did 4 builds there, so he had to kind of catch up. He didn't do 4 runs. Every time I built, he just kind of added it onto the list and did 1 catch-up at the end. But that way you should always be able to look over there when you have the continuous test runner turned on, and you should always be able to see what the state of your unit tests are. It makes it very easy when you're coding. Just build, build, build. Now, I had somebody say to me once, yeah, well, it should just do it on save. Okay, so you bind Control S to build. Because if you think that it's ever going to run tests without doing a build in the background, you're confused, right? Clearly, it has to do a build at some point. And in Visual Studio 2012, the build completely is non-blocking. The UI does not get blocked at all. So if you really do want it to build on save, bind Control S to build. I'm not kidding. It works great. Now, I just happen to use the build command, and I never save. Because they're both the same in my mind. They should end up with the same result. Now, there are clearly some things we can do to make this better, and we are investigating them. Right, so right now, I said we choose the failed tests. And once they pass, we then run the whole suite. Well, we have some ideas for a whole lot more strategies that we might be able to make available there. Strategies for the selection of the correct tests to run, including data from test impact or data from the code index. Have you guys seen the visualization and modeling SDK now has this thing called the code index? If you go and look on blogs, MSDN blogs, you'll find a bunch of stuff written about it by Jean-Marc Prieur. And the code index is building up this index of your code. And so we're trying to think about how we can use that information. There's a lot of things that we're thinking we can use, and maybe even historical information from TFS. We don't have any of that now, but these are ideas that we've got for how we can start to make this feature better, smarter, faster, as we continue down the road here. So anyway, turning it on was super easy. If you are the person who likes menus, it's right there. Okay? There's a number of other things up here in the menu, in case you care. If you want to force it to run in a particular architecture, it's as simple as a checkbox now. No screwy test settings files. And that's pretty much it. We intentionally simplified this down so that you could just focus on writing tests and writing code. Okay. So, more stuff to talk about here. Based on that fakes product that I showed you earlier, we're working on and we hope to deliver in we're going to be doing these interim releases, these feature pack releases, after RTM. And you may have seen on Jason Zander's blog, he mentioned that there's going to be a bunch of great stuff in that first feature pack for SharePoint development. Any of you guys do SharePoint? Okay. Have you ever tried to unit test SharePoint? Right? Try to unit test your web part? So we're going to be producing and providing a test emulation library for SharePoint that uses fakes under the covers and basically makes it so that you can write unit tests for your SharePoint stuff without having to bring up a full instance of SharePoint. Now, of course, integration tests and functional tests and end-to-end tests are still going to want to run against a full SharePoint. But while you're coding those dev tests, you still want to be able to run those, you want to be able to run them quickly, and you want to be able to isolate those from that real environment. Otherwise, it's just too painful to work in. So we're going to be working on that. If you are somebody who is interested in that, who's interested in unit testing and TDD and Agile and SharePoint and all that other stuff, I would love to have a chat with you at some point while we're here this week, just so I can understand the scenarios and make sure we address that properly and don't have any big gaps. And I mentioned this before, but of course this stuff is in the Express versions of Visual Studio. It's in Express for Windows 8, Express for the newly announced Express for Windows Desktop, and it's also in Express for Web. So if you're using the Express SKUs or if you know somebody who is, they have the same unit test experience. Now, they do not have the continuous test runner checkbox, and they can't use third-party frameworks. And again, the Express products do not allow plugins or extensions. That's the preventer there. So, but they do at least get the opportunity to write unit tests with their code and to do the right thing there. So if you are a user of MS Test from the Visual Studio 2010 days or earlier, then there's some things that you may wonder where they are, wonder what's going on there. Test lists, if you had them, if you used them, they're still supported if you have one. So if you have a 2010 project with test lists, it still works. If you create one of those files by yourself, it will still work. But we are strongly moving away from those. They were very problematic. The problem with test lists in general was that they had to be manually maintained. So if you wanted to put a test, if you wrote a new test, you had to remember to open the test list and drag it into the list. And then you write five new tests and wonder why they're not, oh, gotta drag them into the list again. So what we've been thinking about is how to fix that with a better experience. And if you've got your favorite music player around, you can imagine the kinds of things that we might want to model on in a music player, like an auto playlist kind of a thing in iTunes or Zune. We're thinking about those kinds of things. But right now, test lists are basically considered a legacy mode feature. The test impact thing, which we shipped in 2010, is a really powerful feature. It works really well in MTM and on the build server. It never really worked in the IDE. And rather than invest a whole bunch of cycles trying to figure out how to make it work, we decided to remove it from the IDE and instead replace it later with something that does work. This has caused some heartache for a few people, but I'm being completely open and honest with everybody. It really didn't work in the IDE. It works great on the build server, but it just did not work correctly in the IDE. The scenario it was designed for was the TDD scenario, the scenario where you're writing tests and code back and forth very rapidly. It was too slow, and it would miss tests. And if it's going to recommend a test list for you to run, it shouldn't miss any. That's clearly a non-starter. So we pulled it out. We do have intentions sometime in the future of providing an equivalent but better feature. You may have also used the private accessors generator in previous versions of Visual Studio. Now, in the documentation for 2010, it was marked as deprecated, and in 2012, it has been removed. Private accessors allow you to test private methods using some very ugly reflection techniques. You're still free to use the very ugly reflection techniques. We're not going to generate it for you. And if you want to hear my own personal rant on that, I wrote a whole blog post on it a week or so ago about why I hate testing private methods. We'll leave it at that. If somebody wants to ask a question during the Q&A, I will answer it, but hopefully we don't end up crying. This is my obligatory baby photo. You gotta put a baby photo in every slide deck. So hopefully you saw that our focus here in 2012 was on the developer, on the person who writes code and writes unit tests every day. My teams sit together in a team room, they pair program, they do TDD, and we have been consuming this product on our own in our teams for the entire dev cycle. In fact, we originally wrote it on Visual Studio 2010 because that's where you start when you're building 2012. And we have been self-hosting and self-consuming this from day one. We've been writing tests in all the different frameworks. We've been using the code coverage. We've been using all these features. And we've been evolving it as we've been going based on our own feedback and the feedback from customers like yourselves, both at CTP and at beta and now at RC. We are going to be continuing to evolve this feature. We're not going to stop. We're going to keep going, and we're going to keep making it better. But the focus has been on developers and unit tests. So we have mics here. We have about 8 minutes. So I'm going to ask that you please, if you have a question, step up to the mic. If you want to wait or if you think of a question later, I will be down at the TLC, and here's some of my contact information. Yes, sir.
The third-party features and the code coverage, do they work starting with professional, or do they start at premium and ultimate?
So the question, the third-party extensibility plugins work starting at professional.
Yeah.
I'm drawing a blank as to at which SKU the code coverage feature appears. So I apologize, I don't have that, but I will get it for you. If you come and find me at the booth, I'll have that answer for you for sure. My mind blanked on me. I'm just looking at the mics to see if I can see anybody. Okay, there's about 4 or 5 minutes left. If you have any other questions, like I said, I'll still be here. I'll also be down at the booth. Thank you very much. Have a great rest of your tech ed.